From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, our Capital Bureau Chief Marianne Russ sits down with Governor Schwarzenegger in his famous cigar tent. They talk about California's financial problems and more. Plus, if you thought book review magazines were disappearing, think again. A couple have started a monthly one in Sacramento. Since last September, they've reviewed many hundreds of books of all kinds. And Tahoe City's new youth ballet takes to the stage. First, we continue our short series on how local governments of different kinds are dealing with big budget cuts brought on by the recession and California's financial crisis. Yesterday, we heard about social service cuts in Sacramento County and parks and recreation cuts in Placer County. Today, we'll hear how the city of Woodland is dealing with cuts to its public safety departments. Joining me is Woodland City Manager Mark Devon. Mark, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
How does next year's public safety budget in Woodland, the fire and police, compare to this year's?
Well, obviously our budget is going to be very much smaller during fiscal year 2010. In the fire department, probably the most significant cut is that we have seven unfilled firefighter positions, and we will not be able to fill those positions at all. In fact, they're going to be actually proposed for deletion from our budget. So we'll be down seven firefighters, which means that we will be operating our four engine companies with three firefighters per engine company, which will cut down our efficiency and our ability to respond to major incidents and things like structure fires very significantly. We're also going to have four less police officer positions in our police department budget, and we're looking at less resources towards things like crime prevention and fire education. We're reducing a DARE police officer as well. So there's some significant reductions in public safety that we're looking at in the fiscal 10 budget.
I'm looking at a staff report to the mayor and city council of Woodland dated May 26, 2009, prepared by your office, I expect, and it says that the projected cuts to the police department would total about $860,000. Roughly, what kind of percentage of the police budget is that?
That's approximately 5% of the police budget, and I think in the fire department we were a little higher, I think.
Over $1 million.
Yeah, over $1 million, and I think we were at about 12% in that area.
Why such a larger percentage cut out of the fire department than the police department?
Well, part of it is the types of incidents that the police department responds to are more numerous than what the fire department responds to. The majority of the fire department's response are to emergency medical aid calls. So that is something that can comfortably be handled by a three-person firefighter crew that can respond to emergency aid calls. The police department has other issues where we're in, particularly in the area of violent crime, where we need multiple officers to respond at any one time to situations where we might have to make a felony arrest or do something along those lines, and it's just a matter of trying to determine which balance is the right way to go, and with some of the advances that have been made in the past on building inspections and building safety and fire sprinklers and so forth, the majority of our response in fire is certainly focused on emergency medical aid as opposed to structure fires. However, I do want to emphasize, in the fire department area, whenever we have to respond to multiple simultaneous incidents, that is definitely going to stretch our resources and going to require us to either have mutual assistance from our neighboring fire services, primarily the city of Davis, or it's going to require us to call people back on overtime.
The report that I referred to does say, though, that the National Fire Protection Association, the NFPA, recommends minimum levels of staffing for different kinds of fires. And it says here that the City of Woodland's Fire Department would be operating below that standard recommended by this National Fire Protection Association.
That is correct. This is a matter of the kind of fire protection that we're able to afford as opposed to the kind of fire protection that a national association is recommending for us. That's a choice that we have to make, unfortunately, given these resources that we're dealing with.
talking a bit more about the reduced number of firefighters and police officers, you said that you could tap mutual aid, go to neighboring jurisdictions to get help if there was an emergency beyond the new resources of the City of Woodlands Public Safety Departments. But just in general, when you're not in an emergency situation, is there anything that the City of Woodland is trying to do to try and make up for the loss of these police officers and firefighters?
Well, we're trying to really focus on what our most essential missions are in each area. In the area of the fire department, our mission is to respond to emergencies and attack fires and protect life and property. In this case of the police department, our primary mission is to maintain law and order and respond to emergencies. So some of the things that we've done in the area of public education and outreach and things like that, as examples, public fire prevention workshops, public open houses in our fire departments, crime prevention workshops in our police department, neighborhood watch meetings and open houses that our police department has offered as outreach tools to our community. We're not going to be able to offer those anymore. We're having to reduce the staff that have provided that in the past. The DARE program, wherein we've educated fourth graders in our elementary schools, a great program, a very good program at building school community police relations. We're not going to be able to offer that. We're going to have to focus on what our primary mission is at this point.
My guest is Mark Devon, the city manager of Woodland. We're continuing our short series on insight on how local governments of different kinds are dealing with big budget cuts brought on by the recession and California's financial crisis. When we talk about discontinuing programs like DARE and crime prevention, and also on the firefighter side, weed abatement, that sort of thing, how concerned are you that this is creating problems for the future?
I'm very concerned that it's creating problems for the future. I think it's going to force us to review everything that we do as a city and determine as we go forward what are the most important services that we provide as a city. And for example, you mentioned weed abatement. It's a small amount of money that we have included in our budget in the past for weed abatement, but we may have to step up, for example, the assessment of fines on people who violate the orders to abate their weeds in their vacant properties or other properties that they have. Frankly, that's something that we didn't necessarily want to propose this year in the midst of a recession, in the midst of 12.3% unemployment in Yolo County, but it's something that we may have to do going forward as we restructure ourselves given the new realities of the fiscal environment.
I noticed that one program in the police department that's been returned to funded status, as it says in the report, is graffiti abatement. Now, one might have thought that graffiti abatement would be lumped along with DARE and crime prevention and so on. Why was graffiti abatement put back into funding?
Well, part of it is because I have a personal absolute hatred for graffiti. But aside from that, graffiti is something that will that can devalue property, certainly devalue the appearance of a community, and if not abated, can multiply significantly. One of the main ways that you deal with gang-related issues, assuming that much of the graffiti is related to gang activity, is to abate graffiti essentially as soon as possible. So we felt that we could not abandon the graffiti abatement program. It would have strained. We eventually would have had to get it abated anyway. It would have strained other resources within the city. So we decided that graffiti abatement, it's really in some respects a quality of life issue and a community aesthetics issue. We need to abate graffiti. In fact, one day I'd like to actually put more resources towards that so we can abate it even more quickly than we currently abate it at.
And do you expect to make further cuts in the next fiscal year beyond what's already on the table?
Absolutely. We are practicing something in Woodland that I believe very, very fervently in, which is long-term financial planning. And in our, we project out over a 10-year planning period. And in our 10-year planning period, we see the need to make further reductions in order to get ourselves into fiscal balance. Next year, I'm projecting the fiscal year 2010-2011 fiscal year that we will be needing to reduce about $2.25 million in order to get ourselves into fiscal balance.
Finally, Mark, I'd like to ask you a question, if I may, that relates to public safety in Woodland, although it involves the Yolo County Sheriff's Department, not the Woodland Police Department. And it's the fact that hundreds of people marched in Woodland on Saturday night calling for an independent investigation to the shooting of Luis Gutierrez, a relatively young farm worker who was shot in Woodland by a sheriff's deputy on April 30th. Do you have any position on this you'd like to share with us?
Well, the position would be that we understand the concerns of the community, primarily the Latino community. We have had discussions as a city organization with members of the Latino community and other members of our community who have expressed concerns about this incident. And we certainly understand the desire for an independent review of what has occurred. I understand there's discussions that are beginning to take shape, not only with the city, but with the district attorney office and others. So hopefully we will see that come to some sort of a conclusion that will be acceptable to the community. And while this has certainly been a very, very, very tragic incident, we have to strive to see something good come out of this. And I think if we can strive to have better relations with our community leaders in all areas, that is something that we should certainly try to do.
Mark Devin, Woodland City Manager, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Governor Schwarzenegger sits down in his famous cigar tent to talk about the state budget and more. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did you disagree with something you heard on Insight? Tell us what it was and why at insight@capradio.org. Coming up in Talk of the Nation, the U.S. Secretary of Education on how to improve the nation's schools. Arne Duncan is the former head of public schools in Chicago. Plus, doctors reflect on abortion after the recent killing of physician George Tiller. That's Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. The number one job for Governor Schwarzenegger this summer is working with lawmakers to fix the state's budget deficit. Next year, though, is Schwarzenegger's last as governor before being termed out. What are his thoughts on fixing the deficit, the challenges of governing in California, and his own future? Capital Public Radio's Marianne Russ sat down with the governor to talk about all this and more.
We're here with Governor Schwarzenegger in the famous cigar tent. Since this is radio, Governor, why don't you tell us a little bit about where we are?
Well, we're in a courtyard of the Capitol, and it's beautiful artificial grass that you have here, and a lot of the meetings are being conducted out here. It's a tent, and the tent is more than 20 feet away from the building, so it's within the law when you smoke here, because you can't be closer than 20 feet. And but it's an important place where people can come down, Democrats and Republicans, relax here and have discussions and not be as uptight as being inside the building where they have all the ties on, the jackets and buttoned up and all that. So it's a fun place, and it was a good idea to create this tent in the first place.
Do you get a lot of real work done here, do you think?
Yeah, we get a lot of work done, but especially a lot of the negotiations are being done here in brainstorming sessions.
Let's get to the budget, of course, the topic du jour. I think a lot of people are kind of in disbelief about the size of the problem and also about your proposals to cut completely some welfare programs. And some analysts have said, maybe the governor is bluffing. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, we have a $24 billion deficit, which everyone recognizes, the controller, our budget director, and also the legislative analyst's office. So what we did was we basically cut across the board in order to meet this $24 billion hole. So I don't know what this has to do with bluffing and with anything else. It has to do with reality. And as much as we hate the cuts, and as much as we believe that those cuts will result in further expenses down the line, and especially in healthcare, I think we have to do it because I cannot promise the people something that we don't have. We are right now spending $24 billion more than we take in, so we have to make the cuts.
How firm are you on the no new taxes? I mean, you have said in the past no taxes, and then last year taxes were part of the ultimate solution. How firm are you this year on that?
Well, very firm, because I think that the people send us a message loud and clear that they don't want to be taxed. They want us to go and streamline government. They want us to deliver the services in a more cost-effective way, and we can deliver them more cost-effectively. It's just a question if the legislature is willing to go there and to go and revamp some of the systems and take out the weight and be more streamlined. And I think that's what the people demand, and that's what ought to be done, and that's what the legislators are looking for right now.
There's been a parade of people coming to the Capitol over the last week or so, begging, please don't cut my program. And I'm wondering, how is this affecting you personally, having to listen to this and knowing that you need to make cuts?
I'm very much aware of each person that this affects, you know, when you make cuts like that. I mean, I know the children that will lose teachers, and I know that police officers will be laid off and firefighters. I know that certain vulnerable older citizens will not get their in-home services and all of those kind of things. So I'm very much aware of that. So I think that, when they protest out there, it doesn't make me change the numbers because I cannot go and all of a sudden say, okay, let me cut $1 billion less. Well, how do I feel this $1 billion? I mean, I cannot, like I said, promise what we don't have. So, but I mean, I want to let them know that I know the pain this is going to create, and I know that the inconvenience that it is going to create, and how some people will suffer because of it. But I cannot change anything when it comes to the budget, because numbers are reality. What we have to do is make those necessary cuts, but at the same time inspire the legislature to go and look at it in a creative way, the way we deliver the various different programs, because there's things where we can save money, and that can be then put into those programs. Like, for instance, we don't need court reporters. I mean, we can do this digitally. Why are we still holding on to court reporters? Just because the unions want to hold on and keep their jobs.
Governor, what do you think your legacy is going to be? Are you worried that this budget crisis will overshadow everything else you've tried to accomplish?
Well, first of all, let me just say that I'm more concerned about the state than I'm about myself. I have, concentrated on myself my whole life in bodybuilding and acting and business and everything that I've ever done. And I got to a point in my life where I felt like, you know, that doesn't mean as much to me anymore than maybe giving something back to the state and to my community and to my country. And that's why I work for free. I do this because the state of California is much bigger than me. This is here forever. Whereas I come and go, we're just passing through as governors or as the legislators do. And so I'm just concerned about doing the best job possible, using my celebrity status, using my personality, my talent, and everything that I have to bring the legislators together and to make them agree to a budget that we can really move the state forward and reform some of the systems so that we can do better in the future when we have another financial or another economic crisis.
Do you think you'll still be able to achieve some of the things that you've talked about, education reform or water, healthcare, things like that?
Yes, I think we can. And I think that we are very close to coming to an agreement on the water infrastructure. And I think that that's one of the most important things, and that's something that we have a good chance of doing this summer after the budget negotiations are over. So we got to think big. And we got to take on those challenges, including high-speed rail, including reforming our budgets, our education system, and all of those things. So there's a lot of work ahead, and I think we have a good shot of getting it done.
Now that we have this multi-billion-dollar deficit again, do you have any regrets about cutting the car tax when you first came into office?
No, the car tax was never the problem. The problem was that we have a budget system in place without a rainy day fund, and what created the problem is not that we don't have enough revenues, it's just that our tax system has failed us over and over. Every single time since the 60s, the governors have to raise taxes when there's an economic downturn. Why? Because we have such a volatile tax system that we are relying on the 50% of money from the 1% of rich people. That is based on Wall Street's performance rather than on our economic performance. California, our economy went up by 0.4% since last year. Their revenues dropped by more than 20%. So as you can see, our revenues are not based on our economic activities, and therefore our tax system is wrong. We got to redo our tax system, which is very difficult in this state because Republicans hold on to their principles and Democrats hold on to their principles. But maybe now with this crisis, we maybe are able to make the changes.
There's been a lot of talk about the lack of transparency in the Big Five process, where you and the legislative leaders meet and it's behind closed doors, and that's where the budget's worked out. Republicans have talked about maybe even televising those meetings. How open are you to that, those kinds of ideas?
I think people like to have a time or place where they can meet privately and have discussions. But I think that my Republican colleagues, for instance, want to post always after the Big Five meetings what was talked about. And we immediately said we have no problem with that at all. I personally don't have a problem even with having the whole thing recorded or having, you know, television be part of it. I have no secrets. You know, I'd like to expose the problems and let everyone answer them. So if someone says, well, I think that maybe we should not go and rattle the cage in the prison system, then it's great for me to be able to ask that, why not? Who are you trying to protect and why? You know, I think it has its advantages. As a matter of fact, I have said many times I would like to actually have my office be in a glass house so that the people that walk outside or that walk in the hallway literally can look through my office, through the glass walls like here, and see me working. And see everyone working. It's the people's money, and they should be able to look in.
Democrats have said that they oppose the kind of wholesale elimination of some of the welfare programs like Healthy Families and CalWORKs. How will you convince them to go along with those deep cuts?
They don't have to cut that deep if they go and create efficiency in the way we deliver the programs. So it's their choice. What the system that is in place right now, we have to make those cuts. But if they go and say, look, we can save $2 billion in the prison system and we can change the laws and provide and have those certain services delivered through the private sector, then we can take those $2 billion and put it in a Healthy Family and put it in CalWORKs and Cal Grant and all those kind of things. So it's totally up to them which way they want to go. But one thing we won't go, and that is to create new revenues by asking the taxpayers, because their message was loud and clear. Don't come to us for more money. You figure it out and how to live within your means, because that's what we have to do. And on the end, they're right.
I also wanted to ask you about your future ambitions. There's been much speculation about what you will do when you leave office here. Run for Senate, be an environmental ambassador, go back to Hollywood. Would you want to enlighten us at all about what you're thinking now?
How about opening up a Wiener Schnitzel place? No, but I mean, you know, there's all kinds of rumors going around what I'm going to do. And I don't think about what I'm going to do after. I'm much more a person that is here now, because there's so much work that needs to be done before I'm finished with this office.
The new Terminator movie didn't get great reviews. Maybe they need you back in Hollywood?
I think that the new Terminator was a 7 out of 10. But, you know, I still watch movies. I'm in touch with my colleagues in the movie business and my colleagues in the bodybuilding business and in the fitness business and in the restaurant business. But right now I just concentrate on the state and solving these problems, which I have to say I get more joy out of this job than anything else I've ever done in my life. Because if I think about my life, I mean, I was created a little bit because of my upbringing and my parents. But the majority of it was, you know, you see a big stamp on my forehead that made in America. You know, I'm made in America. And so to me, to give something back now, it makes me feel good.
Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
And talking with the governor was Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief, Marianne Russ. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, how and why a Sacramento couple started a monthly book review magazine. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Go to capradio.org/insight for links, images, and information about our topics and guests. If you thought book review magazines were disappearing, think again. A couple have started a monthly one in Sacramento. Since last September, they've reviewed many hundreds of books of all kinds. Well, these are tough times for many publishers. Why did Heidi Kamlovsky and Ross Rojek decide to start a monthly book review? And how do they run their business? They're in our studio with one of the reviewers, Heidi. Ross, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Heidi, why did you and Ross decide to start publishing a monthly book review just as the recession was kicking in and given all the problems that face so many publishers?
Well, it's kind of crazy to do that, but we saw that the industry was diminishing with print publications and that it was something that the publishers actually needed as a vehicle to get their books publicized. So we kind of revamped the business model of what traditional magazines and newspapers are doing and launched our own, and it seems to be working.
Ross, what does that mean, revamped the business model?
Most book review publications are either sponsored by a university and paid for out of those fees, or they are published by a major newspaper and distributed that way. And when we started working on this last year, as we're going down, New York Times canceled theirs, Chicago Book Tribune canceled theirs, and I actually had a couple publicists say something along the lines of, "What idiot would start a book review publication in this particular time?" We distribute copies in Sacramento. We distribute copies in San Francisco for free. They're available in bookstores and libraries and other places. The big thing is that we don't print as many copies as you would have to in a Sunday Times or a Sacramento Bee or the like. We don't print 400,000 copies.
Yeah, but still you got to pay the bills, Heidi.
Yes, we do. Well, we pay the bills by advertising, and then we have to do something with all of the books. So we generate revenue by selling the excess, and we give a lot of them away,
too. You mean selling the books that are left over?
Yes, because we're getting upwards of 100, 150 books a week, and they go out to the book reviewers, and then we have to keep an office copy, too, for reference, because I can't tell you how many times a reviewer flakes on us at the last minute, and I have it slated to go into the next publication, and so we end up having to do a book review on our own. So we have to always have an office copy.
Talking with Heidi Kamlovsky and Ross Rojek, the co-publishers of the Sacramento Book Review. Ross is the senior editor and Heidi is the review's graphic designer. One thing I noticed that you do have, and I must ask about this, sponsored reviews. What does that mean?
It's been an increasing thing that authors can choose to self-publish or print on demand. They don't necessarily have to go through a publisher anymore. It's very difficult to get picked up by a publisher these days. So they can go the route of hiring an author house that will do that for them. And because they're not going to have a publicist assigned to their book, they have to pimp it out themselves. So they can choose to submit their book to us just like all the others and just toss it in the pile and hope that one of our book reviewers will pick it up and ask to review it. Or they can go the route of choosing to get a sponsored review. And we have three separate plans for them where they would pay us to do a book review.
How would your readers know that they're reading a sponsored review as opposed to a review that was just spontaneously generated?
We put a tag on the top of it that says sponsored review. And the book reviewers who choose the book, they do not know that it's a sponsored review. So to them, it just looks like it's just like any other book. So there's no bias to their review.
You have a whole bunch of reviewers, don't you?
We have close to 100 right now.
And one of them is with us, Alex C. Talander. Alex, welcome.
Thank you.
What's the secret to writing a great 100-word book review?
It's hard, but it's that short. I'm used to doing at least two or three times the size.
Used to where?
Well, I've been reviewing books for about 10 years now. I started in college for the college newspaper, and then I also review books for bookloons.com, and I have my own website where I keep book reviews up there, too. But the key really is you just want to hit the points about what you liked about the book, but not give too much away so that the reader wants to get the book and read it.
And in the September 2008 edition of the Sacramento Book Review, which was the first edition, there's Reviewing 101, the editor's notes. And Ross, it says, avoid valueless words like amazing, spectacular, and classic. Why?
Because there's no value to them. and that actually is something, as I was putting this together, I remember reading an article in the New York Times Book Review where they went through words that they didn't allow. And they were right, is that, you know, you can describe something as amazing, but that doesn't give a quantity to why it is amazing. Is it amazing because, you know, all of the pictures in the book are, you know, double tucked, they cover both pages? Or is it because, you know, the colors, you have to have a value, you have to have something.
You could be amazingly good and amazingly bad as well.
And that too.
Also in the Reviewing 101, it says, how can you possibly say a book is classic anyway when it's new?
There is that. And in fact, just a couple days ago, Heidi and I were watching TV and some movie ad came on that was talking about it being an instant classic. And I went off on my, it's not a classic until it's been old. It's at least 20 years old.
We're talking about the Sacramento Book Review. Alex, do you specialize in a certain kind of book?
No, I basically get their list they send me of everything they have available, and I kind of pick the whole variety. I like nonfiction and fiction, so I just kind of look through and see what interests me.
So, Heidi, you just send out a list. You and Ross just send out a list to all the reviewers and say, pick what you like?
Yeah, it's a process that's kind of maddening right now that we're trying to fix with technology. We're trying to implement what's kind of widely known as a shopping cart on our website for the reviewers to go in and look at the books that are available, and then they can check them out. Not that they have to buy them, but just check them out. And that way it'll be removed from the inventory. But as it works right now is we add books to our database on a weekly basis. And like I said, we get about 100 to 150 a week. And then we everything goes into a database. And so we query the database for what month, which issue and which month, and then we put that list out to our reviewers and say, first come, first served. And they can generally pick 3 or 4 books. The new reviewers, we start them out slow. They tend to bite off more than they can chew. And so we have some reviewers that can do like 6 or 8 in an issue, and which is pretty amazing. But, you know, we end up having piles of books all over the place with people's names on them. And then we get to go through the process of mailing them out, and then sometimes they get lost in the mail. And luckily, it's not that often that that happens.
Alex, how many books do you review per month for the Sacramento Book Review?
I'd probably do an average of about 4, I would say.
That's a lot. That's one a week.
Yeah, I like reading a lot.
And do you review other books elsewhere?
I do for Book Loons, and then I actually have my own podcast where I do book reviews and author interviews.
Well, in a typical month then, in total, how many books do you read and review for a variety of places?
Well, last year I kept track of how many books I did for the year, and I came in at 90-something.
Oh, my goodness. That's amazing. Ross, a long time ago, you were in the comic book store business.
Yes.
So are you the reviewer of the graphic novels for the Sacramento Book Review?
Not often. If something comes along that I really, really like, you know, I'll grab that one. In fact, this week, and it's going to be in this issue, we got The Art of Harvey Kurtzman, which, you know, not only am I reviewing, but it's going on the shelf, and it's a keeper.
After your spell in the comic book store business, Ross, you actually spent time in federal prison camps. You were arrested for your part in a telemarketing fraud. And I bring this up because not just because it's recent, but also it helped lead you to what you're doing now. Tell us a little bit more first about what you did that led you to be sentenced.
I got involved with some telemarketers for fundraising originally. And then it turned into I ended up borrowing money from them or people that they were working with to try and buy a online retailer, Another Universe. And so we didn't make the amount of money I thought we were going to make off that. And that's kind of still as the dot-com industry was just not picking up. And so as I got further and further into debt and they were pushing, and let's just say this wasn't loans that, you know, coming from a bank, it's you know, pretty shady stuff. And so that was one of the options they gave me, was helping them, you know, basically launder money from these telemarketing operations they were doing. And so it's kind of funny in that when the Bernie Madoff thing was going down, and there, at some point there was a quote from him where he said that when he first started, he thought he could do it just a couple of times and then be back doing business as normal and pay everybody back. And it's the exact same thing that went through my mind as I was doing it was, I only have to do this like one more time and then I don't have to do it again and then I'll pay everybody back, you know, as the business takes off, and it just never did. And eventually it all collapsed.
Did you harm anyone?
Yes. There were about 200 victims. I'm paying restitution, you know, out of every paycheck. And, you know, whether I'll ever be able to pay it all back or not, I'm just keep trying.
How did your time in federal prison help lead you to where you are now?
There was a period where, you know, you're sitting in, you know, a jail cell going, how the hell did I end up here? And, you know, for me, I took that to heart and started figuring out what it was that I'd been doing up through to that point that I didn't like in my life. What did I need to change? What did I want to do next? Because I wasn't going to be able to get out and, you know, get a job in the comic industry again. And, you know, at the same time, I have all this time on my hands, and so I'm reading a lot. And so, you know, it was partially the process of finding new books to read. Therefore, you need to find book reviews or find out what's coming out. And so I'm reading, you know, just about everything I lay my hands on. And that is kind of where I started down the road of, well, you know, this book review isn't great. And I'm reading the New York Times every week, but I'm not finding, you know, very many books in there that I'm interested in. And so kind of I started making this checklist, and then I wrote it down and I started designing, if I was ever going to do my own book review, what would I want in it? And which eventually developed to this.
Heidi, did you and Ross talk about the Sacramento Book Review when he was still in prison?
No, we had just been casual friends for several years prior to him going to prison, and we just reconnected when he got out and started dating. And he started talking to me about the book review, which I wasn't involved with initially. And the more we talked about it and realized that our skill sets together was just a perfect match for doing this together rather than him just doing it, it was just logical to start it. And so we just kind of conceptualized it over the summer of 2008 and then launched our first issue in September. And the rest is just kind of history.
And what are your plans beyond the Sacramento Book Review? To expand it elsewhere?
We would like to expand. We would like to license it out. The way that we've kind of designed the model is to have it be like a niche city book review around the country. We don't want to be nationwide in that it's cookie cuttered across the nation. We want it to be unique for each city, where it will have local authors, local advertisers, local calendar. And so you would have, you know, like Houston Book Review or Manhattan Book Review. And we have a few people who are interested in doing that.
Okay. Well, for now, it's the Sacramento Book Review. Yeah. And finally, Alex Tillander, reviewer, give us a book that you've enjoyed recently and you might recommend.
Oh, I'm reading about five at the moment. One I just started reading, actually, it's not for the Sacramento Book Review, but it's called Panama Fever. And it's all about the history of Panama and how they built it. And it starts right from the beginning, back when Columbus was trying to find the Orient, basically, and thought maybe we could put something through here.
Great. Well, thank you all so much. That's Alex Tillander. He's one of the reviewers at the Sacramento Book Review, which started publication last September. It's a monthly book review. And the co-publishers, Heidi Kamlovsky and Ross Rojek, are with us. Ross is the senior editor. Heidi is the review's graphic designer. Thank you all so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Tahoe City's new youth ballet takes to the stage. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. There's an Insight podcast. You can sign up at capradio.org/insight. Coming up this afternoon from Capital Public Radio News, workers' comp insurance rates in California could rise by more than 23% next month. That story and more later today on All Things Considered. A professional ballet dancer has returned to Lake Tahoe to start her own company for young artists. She's Kristen Hanna, and her Tahoe Youth Ballet debuts this Saturday on the program a variety of dances, including the world premiere of a piece choreographed by Hanna herself. She joins us along with some other dancers. We'll start with Kristen. Kristen Hanna, welcome to Insight.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, you've danced in New York and around the country and overseas. Why did you decide to come back to Tahoe and start a youth ballet company?
Well, I started coming back here to teach some workshops at a local school that had started since I grew up here. And I really, really, really enjoyed working with the girls because they were really, really, really eager for information. And they just basically soaked everything up. So it was a chance to really have a captive audience. And, you know, there wasn't anything here when I was growing up here. So it was nice to kind of give back to my community in that way.
When you say growing up here, where exactly did you grow up in the Tahoe area?
I grew up on the West Shore in Tahoma, but I went to school in Tahoe City.
Yeah. Do you still dance professionally?
Well, I had my official retirement from the company that I most prominently danced for in New York, but I'm taking the stage this Saturday, so back by popular demand, I guess you could say.
Now, I understand that you got a good review from the New York Times in your farewell performance, a testament to Ms. Hanna's fine dancing, it said.
Yeah, the company there was really a very intimate experience, and it was really nice because, you know, we had the kind of following where everybody could basically, you know, all of our audience basically got to know the dancers very well, and they had followed our careers. And so when I had my farewell performance, everybody knew, and it was very emotional, and myself and several audience members were actually in tears. So it was nice to have that kind of a send-off. Not everybody gets that.
I can imagine. Kristen Hanna is artistic director of the Tahoe Youth Ballet. The company makes its debut this Saturday evening in Tahoe City. Also with us are a couple of dancers in the ballet. They're both called Sierra is their first name, Sierra Barter and Sierra Walsh. Sierra and Sierra, welcome to Insight.
Hi.
Yes. Sierra Barter, tell us a little bit about your background as a dancer and what your plan is when you grow up, when you're older, rather.
Well, I started dancing when I was, I think, 6 years old. And then as I got older, I just got more and more interested in ballet and contemporary and modern. And I ended up auditioning for Lyons Ballet School when I was, I think, 12 years old. And I made it into their summer program. And then from then on, it's been just like a constant love for doing it, and I keep on going away every summer, and I plan on pursuing a professional career after I graduate high school.
Well, it's one thing to go to ballet classes and dance classes, but it's another thing to be a member of a company. How does that feel?
It's good. It's definitely different, but I like how I get a kind of a feel with this Tahoe Youth Ballet of how it would be like if I miss a rehearsal. It's, you know, I have to inform her a month ahead and have a good reason why, and I can't miss for, you know, I want to go to a school function after school or something like that. So I really enjoy it.
That's Sierra Barter. Sierra Walsh, also a dancer. Sierra, just give us a quick summary of your background in dance and what you plan to do yourself.
Well, I started dancing when I was 4, and I have gone to my first summer program last year. I was 12. I turned 13 in July, and I went to ABT, and that was really fun, and I realized at the camp how much I love to dance, and this year I'm going to Pennsylvania for 5 weeks for a camp, and I am loving it more and more every time I dance.
Kristen Hanna, you're the artistic director of the Tahoe Youth Ballet. How much of your time is spent teaching the dancers, and how much is directing them or even choreographing them?
Well, I also teach at Tahoe Dance School, which is where the girls study, and I audition students there to be a part of the company, so I do teach them in regular classes. Our company time, other than, you know, a warm-up for class before rehearsal, is primarily spent for choreography. But, you know, they are young dancers. They're not seasoned professionals, so we do have to stop and go over technical aspects sometimes rather than just give steps. But for me, that's part of the fun of working with them and, you know, really giving them a chance to explore the new things that they're doing.
But there is another seasoned professional on the phone with us, Britton Spittler, as guest artist in the Tahoe Youth Ballet. Britton, welcome.
Thank you.
What are you doing with the company at this time?
At this time, Kristen had me come in to do a piece with the younger girls, the young professionals, and also she and I choreographed a piece together, which we will be performing as well. So,
yeah. Now, tell us a bit more about that piece, Kristen, because this is the world premiere of a piece. That sounds like it could be an exciting moment for you.
It is, actually. The piece that Kristen and I choreographed together, it's a 6.5-minute ballet, and it's just something that both of us really, we worked very hard for a very long time together on putting our emotions and our hearts into it, as well as listening to the music and trying to show these younger dancers what we've worked for and what, if they continue to pursue this career, what they can do as well. The other piece, the piece that I'm doing with the younger professionals, that's also been very exciting because, you know, Kristen choreographed that one as well, and they get to work with me, I've been dancing professionally for the past 3 years, and it's fun to be a part of that because Sierra, one of the girl who I'm dancing with, Sierra Walsh, every time that we've worked together, she does maybe a little turn or something with me, and she gets so excited afterwards because she hasn't had a lot of partnering with a guy before. So it's really fun for me to be able to see the younger professionals and how they can grow up through just this small experience with an outside professional.
Well, Sierra Walsh, tell us about that experience from your point of view.
Well, I love it. It has been really fun, and it's scary, but I mean, I love it, and it's really fun. And every time I do it, I learn more, and Britt, he teaches me a ton, and he's taught me how to partner over the last few days, and I can't wait to show everyone what I've learned.
I bet. Kristen Hanna, how much of what the Tahoe Youth Ballet does and is going to do is classical ballet, Swan Lake and so on, and how much of it is modern ballet?
Well, the pieces that we're performing this Saturday, all of them are in pointe shoes. My first piece, the world premiere for the girls, which Britain is joining them in, is it's very classical. And then the pas de deux that Britt and I have choreographed is a little more contemporary, but still in pointe shoes. And then Miro Magloire's Preludes is, again, back to the more classical. And then the final piece, which is actually choreographed by Deborah Losey, who's a California Rockland native, is far, far, far more contemporary. So I kind of hope to keep a nice balance of the few, and I'm looking into doing some more starkly modern things in the future combined with the ballet.
And we're just about out of time, Kristen, but do you plan to do the Nutcracker at Christmas time?
I don't. right now what makes it manageable with the kids is that we're a fairly small ensemble. These kids, some of them are in band. They all have various activities. I don't expect them to drop everything else in their lives. But Nutcracker is a pretty big production. I think that's a little bit far away, maybe in the future.
I understand. Well, thank you so much. Kristen Hanna, Artistic Director of the Tahoe Youth Ballet. The company makes its debut this Saturday evening in Tahoe City at the NTHS Theatre. Two of the dancers also joined us, Sierra Barter and Sierra Walsh, and guest artist Britton Spittler. Thank you all so much for joining us, and best wishes.
Thank you very much.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more on the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver and Kelly Menemeyer. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Author of The Omnivore's Dilemma speaks in Sacramento this week. On the next Insight, Michael Pollan tells you about his new book, In Defense of Food, and about his work in environmental and food journalism. Also, a photo exhibit tells a long history of the Catholic Church in Sacramento. Plus, you'll meet comics performing in a new comedy series. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight
tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.